In connection with the announcement Larry Widmer made to you, I might mention to you that our newsletter goes out to friends in other states. In the last one, I mentioned that if 100 of us gave $500, we could complete our building next door instead of waiting a few years. A couple of days ago, that newsletter item came back with my comment circled and a check enclosed from a lady living in retirement in Arizona for her $500. She is the same lady you read about in the bulletin this morning as the giver of our new candelabra. She has done her part, I think. Since we have honored both children and their teachers this morning, it seems a logical time to say something about children and their parents and how they can both survive one another. I realize that the topic may seem irrelevant to some of you, but you may wish to think about it anyway, since you have relatives or friends with children who may, in desperation, ask you for advice. Not that advice is in short supply. Everybody seems to have a proverb for the perplexed parent. Here's a quick sampler on bringing up children. Spend on them half as much money and twice as much time. Or this from a pair of harassed parents: give a child enough rope and she will trip you up. And this odd prophecy, which is often enough true to give a little comfort: likely as not, the child you can do the least with will do the most to make you proud. I've seen that happen more than once. And cynical as it sounds, there is a great deal of truth in this one. The secret of dealing successfully with a child is not to be its parent. But if you are already, that doesn't help much, so let's look around a little. I suppose it has struck some of you that the Bible has almost nothing to say about how children develop. A few scattered verses in Proverbs offer advice, but some are fuzzy and some seem out of date. The most famous maxim in that Jewish school book goes like this: train up a child in the way it should go, and when the child is old, it will not depart from that. This has a marvelously reassuring ring, but on closer look, it isn't all that helpful. I have a little trouble with both ends of it. Train up a child in the way it should go. Splendid advice, but how should it go? The advice is so broad and general that both parents and churches interpret it to mean whatever they want it to mean. And the promise that if you do this, the child will forever after keep to the right course has probably caused as much anguish to parents as any verse in the Bible. It has enough truth in it to offer hope, but understood as a promise to which there are no exceptions, it has broken the hearts of those who blame themselves entirely when their child goes wrong. Parents are not the only influence. They deserve neither all the credit nor all the blame. I have trouble, too, with the grim and heavy view of discipline we get in the book of Proverbs. I may be remembering my own past when I wince at a verse like this. Folly is deep-rooted in the heart of a boy. A good beating will drive it right out of him. This ancient expert in child psychology has no help to give us about what to say when our kids ask about God, sex, and death, but he seems to have no doubt at all about the wonder-working power of a switch. I would probably use that kind of punishment less than I once did, although I cannot judge to save my life what difference it made in the boy who was spanked a lot and the boy who was spanked very little. All I know is that I don't smile quite as broadly as I would have once when I hear a famous bishop say, every child should have an occasional pat on the back as long as it is applied low enough and hard enough. The truth is that I'm very uncertain about how to interpret my own experiences as a child. I got into much trouble through curiosity and stubborn will, and my father had no qualms about using a belt or a switch or his hands if he couldn't wait. Should I blame him for my impatience with less than perfection? Or should I credit him for having taught me to know that if I do wrong, I can expect punishment? Character is too complex to unravel in a pulpit. All I know for sure is that I never had an instant's doubt that my father loved me more than his own life, and that he would do everything within his power to prove it. And in the long run, my knowing that may have been the greatest gift he had to give me. If I could go back and change anything, it would probably be not my father's discipline, which I sorely needed, but his dogmatic certainty about religion that gave him so much pain when I grew up and could no longer share it. I hope no one misunderstands me. I think children are lucky who have parents who care about religion. At its best, religion represents a serious effort to understand and live in harmony with other people and the natural world, to deal with the bittersweet brevity and risk of human life, with the certainty of sorrow, with the meaning of illness and death. A child with no sense of the role religion plays in human life is a deprived child. So a child needs to be told clearly at some point that certain things are matters of faith with her parents. And when the time is right, a child should be told why they are. If your religion is an accident of birth, you say so, honestly. I'm a Congregationalist, you say, because I happen to be born into a Congregationalist family. I suppose it's likely that if I had been born into a Buddhist family, I would be a Buddhist. Or if somewhere along the line you were convinced by somebody's argument, then you say that honestly. I had an uncle who taught my father to reject his childhood church and join a different one. Afterward, as is often the case with converts, my father rested in the unalterable conviction that now he had the final truth, and that for some odd reason, not too many others had found it. It would have given me a considerable jump start in decent theology if he had admitted to me one day, "Your Uncle Clell convinced me that this is where I should be, but I suppose if I hadn't met him, I would have been something else." That one simple confession would have saved me from several years of religious arrogance. I would plead with any parent to feel that just because you were born into a faith or adopted one, it's not always in the best interests of your child to stay where you are. I say this because there are literally millions of parents who do not believe this. I could not count anymore the young people I have met who have run the gamut from simple hypocrisy to mental collapse in their efforts to settle the claims of religion without quarrels at home, without breaking their parents' hearts. They should not have to feel that way. I remember comments like these from students I have taught. A boy confesses to being a Southern Baptist, but says he only stays in that church to keep peace with his parents. For him, the price of harmony is hypocrisy. A girl writes in a personal essay, "I had 14 years of Catholic schooling. I come from generations of Irish Catholic ancestors. I am the oldest of 8 church-going Catholics. I met and married a former Episcopalian, probably the first non-Catholic I dated. We have practiced birth control and other no-nos. We do not attend church except on holidays. And when my folks visit," hypocrites that we are, "I need to decide what I believe." I had the impression that she would not dare say such things to her parents. And what a pity that parents should cut themselves off from that kind of dialogue. Now, those are very mild comments, actually. I've been with people who have come totally apart emotionally because of stress and strain over religion. What a legacy to give a child. Attitudes that make religion a source of misery instead of comfort and consolation. There are thousands of homes, even in this city, where religion is taboo as a topic. "You can visit," mom says, "but please don't bring up your religious views. It only ends in a fight." If one happens to care deeply about religious ideas and yearns to talk about them with the most important people in life, this is a tragic restriction. Parental inflexibility may not stop growth and change, but it certainly causes pain. And as often as not, it drives children into far more radical positions than they would otherwise have taken. Not just in religion, but in matters also of politics and certain social customs, the content of an orthodoxy is not the problem so much as the fact of an orthodoxy. It's the teaching of absolute and unchangeable attitudes that causes grief. The declaration that everything is fixed and final, and that one is not to think about it or raise a serious question. I have heard parents browbeat their children in words like these: if you loved us and appreciated all we've done, you'd put ideas like that out of your head. All that does is to make a child either ashamed or defiant. It does not free a son or daughter to become strong and resilient and independent, which is what parenthood is all about. There is a guide to behavior that could help us. I cringe at how trite it's going to sound, but it's been worn out by repetition for the very reason that it is the truth. We should try very hard to be honest with children. Intelligently honest, compassionately honest, but honest. To pretend to a child, for example, that religion is always a force for good is a lie. And one day when the child discovers for herself that that is so, she will wonder how many other lies you have told. It was not that you meant to lie. You were just so eager to foster certain attitudes that you got careless about being truthful. I would try to tell a child what religion has done for people and what it has done to them, so that he could know that it has been used well at times and disastrously at others. That some expressions of religious faith bless the world in rich and wondrous ways, and that some religious feelings promote bigotry and hatred and even death. A child will find this out anyway. I happen to think it would be a sustaining memory to have had truth from the very first people we trust. One last reminder: in this whole business of religion and values, the most constant mistake we make as parents is the assumption that if we tell our children the right things, they'll do them. They'll turn out right. Children may do for a while what you tell them, but they are far more likely to do ultimately and permanently what you have shown them. What they need more than commandments are object lessons, pictures of what adult behavior is like at its best. I realize what a terrifying responsibility that throws back on parents, but it has to be faced. Neither church nor school can come anywhere close to the shaping influence of your home. Expecting school to make my child curious and thoughtful when I never show a sign of either one is a high-risk hope. Expecting church to make my child honest if she sees me cheating every day is an exercise in futility. You can almost bet, however, that I will blame something else the church, or the school when my child turns out to be just like me? Do I sound like a professor who might substitute credit for marching band, ballet, or basket weaving for a course in how to be a parent? I would be strongly tempted. I'd like to risk one more adage, so hackneyed I will not blame you if you have a small spasm in your pew. It applies to 100 activities, but to none more than parenting. And I have alluded to it already under different terminology. One picture is worth 1,000 words. If the image kept in the mind comes from the two people who first taught us the meaning of love and discipline, it will be worth 10,000 words. Demonstrate the life you want your children to have and trust them to be drawn to the strength and beauty of it. They will be if it's beautiful. They will be pulled back to it even after a hiatus of several confused and chaotic years if the memories are right. And you are the memory maker.